no more than that, we'll begin Dave Jason's performance and presentation on ragtime music. Should be entertaining as well as educational for most of us, all of us. David Jason has had a quite varied career. Varied career. Working originally in the commercial record industry, more recently in the academic arena, where he is currently associate professor and chairman of the Department of Communications Arts at C.W. Post Center of Long Island University. He is also an author for whom I think the word prolific is certainly appropriate. He's written 9 books altogether, 3 of them on the subject of ragtime. He's produced, he says, 40 reissue LPs, maybe more than that, and also cut 4 original LPs of his own, his ragtime playing. And I can tell you, in the New York metropolitan area and more broadly in the United States, he's very popular as a teacher and a ragtime performer. Dave Jason.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Tim. I hope I am no longer a stranger to you, having sort of made a pest of myself yesterday. What I was trying to do is entice more of you into a riot, and it didn't work. Damn. Today, no such luck. You had your opportunity yesterday, and it was very interesting this whole day today. In the morning, whether by great design or totally accidental, Tim arranged to have 2 hopefully discographies totally dissimilar talked about, and then this afternoon, mine that has been out for 7 years, already completed, so I don't have to go through the sweating that those gentlemen had to go through. I did mine long before that. And how different we all treat the field of discography. I love Steve Smolian's cavalier dismissal of matrix numbers, for instance, as being totally superfluous to his needs. And indeed, each field of endeavor will pose its own problems, its own specialties, and I'll be discussing that briefly in the field of recorded ragtime. And to drag poor Dick Spotswood into the discussion for his start of ethnic discography, it's only fair to blame him, if you will, for the fact that I'm standing here now, because it was Dick who, in a weak moment, when I was sort of talking out loud to him many years ago about the need for a ragtime discography, who said, well, why don't you do it? And my immediate reaction was, well, it's too much like work, and why should I, and how can I get materials? And he really gave me the kick by saying, well, you can start with my collection. Those collectors of you out there will appreciate what I went through, the exquisite torment Fabrizio got to me for the moment, and the decision then to go ahead and what a wonderful, under the guise of doing research, you see, I could prowl through collections of records, and what kind of collections were they? They were jazz record collections. There was no such thing as a ragtime collection or a ragtime collector until I happened on the scene, which was fortunate on the one hand for me, and on the other hand, when you're starting out in a field that doesn't exist, it's not so easy. So on anyway, thank you, maybe, Dick Spotswood. 7 years ago, my discography of recording of ragtime recordings was published by Archon Books, entitled Recorded Ragtime. That was a quick advert. You didn't notice it, it just sort of slipped by. Archon Books. It was a product of 5 years' work, collecting information throughout the world from the beginning of the commercial manufacturing of the gramophone and recording ragtime in 1897 through the end of the 78 RPM disc being manufactured in 1958. It all started because I'm a collector of these breakable 78 RPM discs and wanted to find out whatever and how much was recorded on these discs and eventually, of course, get them all. So the motive was selfishness. Greed. I and many other collectors thought that there were possibly a couple of hundred ragtime recordings. Dark ages. It turned out that there were a couple of thousand. 1897 was a good year for ragtime and inventions pertaining to ragtime. The first rag, Louisiana Rag, by Theodore Northrop, was published in sheet music form in October of that year. Player pianos were first made available to the public in that year. There have been jazz discographies, however, as a non sequitur, I did mention that the only collectors with ragtime recordings were jazz record collectors. And there had been jazz discographies. The first was written by an Englishman, Hilton Schliemann, and he called his Rhythm on Record. The second was done by a Frenchman, Charles Delaunay, who called his The Hot Discography. Both were published in 1936. Naturally, since jazz is an American art form, and therefore most jazz recordings up till then were to be found in America, these fellows had all the materials at their fingertips. The first American jazz discography appeared in 1942 and was put together by a syndicate. Therefore, they divided the blame or passed it off on each other. The only trouble with that one, called the Jazz Record Book, was that they followed Delaunay by grouping artists by styles. The syndicate, headed by Charles Edward Smith, made comments about the selected recordings done by their chosen artists. And so jazz discography languished until 1960, when a painstaking Englishman, Brian Rust, issued what became in later editions a two-volume set simply called Jazz Records, and set the standard for jazz discography. It was Rust who listed all jazz records alphabetically by artist, including personnel, place, and date of recording, matrix number, title of tune, record company, and record number. As jazz is defined by how a piece is played rather than as a form of music, the performer is the most important thing, and Rust, by listing the discs alphabetically by performer and then chronologically, made life very easy for every user. Gone were trying to figure out just what style the artist in question played in. As many prominent performers played with various bands in several styles, finding the artists had been an almost impossible task, as they'd be listed in several areas. Now, with Rust, their entire output was listed under the leader's name. Rust's index is indispensable for locating such a bandsman's diverse recordings. In the field of blues and gospel, tangential to jazz, they have a standard discography compiled by two Englishmen, John Godrich and Robert Dixon. This came out in 1969 and followed the format devised by Brian Rust. And that's it for blues and gospel records from 1902 to 1942. Joining these in 1973 was my book, Recorded Ragtime, 1897 to 1958. As there had been nothing like it ever, I had several basic questions to answer. The first being, what is ragtime? Ever since it was published and recorded, Publishers, record company executives, piano roll producers have skirted it by hanging such strange and exotic labels as two-step, characteristic march, Ethiopian idol. Believe it or not, all these turn out to be rags. And then there is the converse problem. Do you believe everything that's called rag? When ragtime became popular, everybody wanted to join the bandwagon, as they still do today, and called every kind of popular music, this, that, or the other, rag. Irving Berlin, that mysterious rag. Oh, you beautiful rag. They're all pop songs. He never wrote a rag in his life. And much of it wasn't ragtime at all, but foxtrots or popular ballads. In fact, most of these songs weren't even syncopated at all. Most of them had words. Horrors. The most well-known being, of course, Alexander's Ragtime Band. Pop songs, I may add parenthetically, have, up to 1960 anyway, two parts to them, the verse, which nobody knows, and the chorus, which everybody knows. When I began looking through record catalogs, I jotted down everything with rag in the title. I eventually weeded out those tunes which weren't rags at all, but what of those rags which didn't indicate by title that they were rags at all? A good example being Belle of the Philippines. It turns out to be a rag, but unless you heard it, you wouldn't know it was one from its title alone. Then there was another problem. Was the record that was listed in the catalog ever issued? Just because it's in the catalog is no guarantee that the record company ever came out with it. There were two main record companies in the United States before the First World War, the Victor Talking Machine Company and Columbia Graphophone Company. And while going through the Victor and Columbia catalogs and master files were helpful, what about the 500 or so small record companies, most of whom were in business less than a year and didn't issue catalogs? Perhaps the greatest source outside the records themselves were the magazines published for the retail record dealer. While we can't trust the record company catalogs, the records listed each month as being available for the dealer were surely manufactured. After all, the company wouldn't advise dealers to stock a record that didn't exist, would they? Another source of listing records known to have been issued was the jazz magazine, which ran auctions. The best of these, Record Changer, VJM, the Vintage Jazz Mart, and Record Research, devoted a good portion of their magazines to those collectors wanting to dispose of their records. Surely they would only list records they owned, and so these lists could be trusted. They very well couldn't sell something they didn't have, or that didn't exist. But getting back to what was ragtime, it wasn't jazz. Therefore, my discography couldn't imitate Rust. The performer wasn't the most important item. The composition was. Since that was the case, I had to determine what ragtime was and what it wasn't. I evolved a definition which gave those properties exclusively to ragtime, things which no other type of music had. Ragtime is the musical composition for the piano, comprising three or four sections, containing 16 measures each, which combines a syncopated melody accompanied by an even, steady, duple rhythm. 29 words, that's it. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. If I might, I just take time out to explore that 29 words for a moment. As you all know, music and ragtime being part of music, although that wasn't generally recognized until 1970, it consists of three basic ingredients: melody, harmony, and rhythm. The opening statement, ragtime is a musical composition for the piano, is not there to waste your time. It really says something quite special. And that is that one can deal with melody, harmony, and rhythm at the same time with the piano. This is not true for hardly any other kind of musical instrument. A trumpet, for instance, by itself will produce a melody. It cannot harmonize with itself at the same time, and it does not provide any other rhythm, outside rhythm. With the right hand of the piano, right hand playing melody, and the left hand playing harmony and creating an outside rhythm, outside of the melody of the piece, one can, at the same time, provide all three. A guitar can only do, well, depending, either one or two. It's either going to play melody or it's going to play harmony and rhythm. But a single guitar can't do. So therefore, when you're talking and saying ragtime is a musical composition for the piano, you're really talking about something quite special. And it comprises three or four sections containing 16 measures each. All right, a section is a complete musical thought, quite simply, and it takes 16 measures. A measure is a unit of time. And 16 of these measures takes approximately 22 seconds to listen to, having a complete thought. Now, which combines a syncopated melody accompanied by an even, steady, duple rhythm? Fine, even, steady, duple rhythm, meaning in two, one and two and. So you have that going on. And you have your syncopated melody. What is syncopation? Quite simply, it's accenting the normally weak beats in the measure. So you're marching along the street, left, right, left, right. What are you accenting? The first and third beats. Right. If you were to do left, right, those are the normally weak beats, and so you'll be syncopating. Now, syncopation is as old as the hills. Good heavens, Big Daddy Bach was syncopating as early as 1700. You all know about Big Daddy Bach, I trust. He was the lad that wore out two wives and had 21 kids, he was known as the greatest organ player of his time. He was using syncopation then, but how was he using it? When he used the syncopation, what he would do is isolate it, suspend his original rhythm, and only do it like a spice in cooking for maybe three or four measures or seven or eight measures at a time, not a complete musical entity. And he also suspended his original rhythm. Ragtime insists, and this is really the distinction, of a complete melody line in syncopation, not something to which syncopation could be added, but created as a syncopated melody, combined at the same time and simultaneously with your duple rhythm. That is exclusively the properties of ragtime. Any questions? You'll have a quiz in 15 minutes. Ragtime started out by being played in saloons and whorehouses. You might call it underground music. At first, there was one theme that was played over and over. And then another theme would be played, having nothing to do with the first theme, these folk themes. If the performer remembered the first theme, perhaps he would play it and then the piece would end. Just long enough to finish your beer, order another one, take a few gulps, you know. It was social music. It was sort of like live Muzak, and provided that same purpose. It was music for socializing. It was in this simple as catch-as-catch-can atmosphere of musical informality that Scott Joplin, an itinerant piano player, was ensconced. Not in whorehouses, because he wasn't good enough. But in saloons did he play, eking out a somewhat precarious living. It was his idea, after completing a two-year course in music, to somehow create order out of this hodgepodge of putting different themes willy-nilly together in the same piece. And so after creating and publishing his first rag effort, willy-nilly, of five assorted themes having nothing to do with one another, called Original Rags, he created a four-themed rag in which each section was related musically to the next and played in the following order. Taking the four sections A, B, C, D, it was A, B, B, A, C, C, D, D. And this was the most famous rag of all, the Maple Leaf rag. And because it became so popular in fact, that it single-handedly gave ragtime its genre and made it, at the same time it established ragtime as an entity unto itself, it also made it a part of popular music and took it out of the folk realm into popular American music. And it is the only popular American music that is not singable or danceable. And all other popular music is either one or both. And because it became so popular, selling by 1909 half a million copies of an instrumental work for the piano, incredible. Every rag published since followed a similar pattern, this AABBACCDD. After all, nothing succeeds like success. And in fact, when it became commercialized and people were actually hired by the publishers to create rags on the spot, they weren't so lofty as Joplin and so high-minded and seeing it as an art form. They wanted to make money and they had to knock out the stuff. They quickly found a way to cut corners and save time. And the first thing they did was they cut it down to three sections, not four. And they easily got around that by making it AABBA, CC, AA, or BB. So you could do without the DD. Save that one for another rag that you were being going to create at the time. In fact, I think at this point I would just like to play for you the Maple Leaf Rag. Let there be light. You lovely fellow back there. I see you winking and blinking. I thought it may be a player, and it's not. And then I wouldn't have to do this, you see. Pardon my back. It's good for throwing knives in. The first section. This is the first section of Maple Leaf Rag. It'll take about 22 seconds of your time. Complete musical thought. Did you notice what made Joplin so brilliant? This is obviously a syncopated march and basic element, and here is the very blatant march formula. But then what did he do? See the syncopation in the right hand against the even, steady rhythm in the left hand. Very un-Sousa-like, which is why Sousa wasn't the genius that Joplin was. He didn't do. Brilliant. The second section. Shot to hell. But that's another complete musical thought. The third section of the Maple Leaf Rag. Taking that nomenclature from the march again. And now what you've all been waiting for, the fourth and last section of the Maple Leaf Rag. Thank you.
That's the whole thing. That's the maple leaf rag.
Oh, come on. I didn't do anything. Now, in fact, what I would like to do is just to show you that it can be a little more lively than dissecting this thing into its four bare component parts. I'd like to offer one way of performing it. Yesterday, called They All Play the Maple Leaf Rag, where there are 15 other versions. And that was the first thing I had, another quick advert I had produced in 1971 for Herwin 401 that needs to be added, it's so well known. Over the years, just to annoy everybody else, I have insisted upon putting other renditions of the Maple Leaf Rag in other of my compilations. And so there is at least another dozen that are available on the reprint market. The last one I went all out on called Late Band Ragtime, and I decided, what the hell, I'll just throw caution to the winds and put out three other versions on that one lovely album. There's no telling what I'm going to do on the next album. But I would never come out with They All Played the Maple Leaf Rag again, volume 2. Together for the Last Time, no. Volume 2, no. Where are we? The form that my discography, yes, remember that one? Recorded Ragtime, Archon Books, available from Archon only. The form that my, or my room, as the case may be, form my discography took, once I decided what ragtime was alphabetizing each rag and then giving an alphabetical sequence the recording artist, and on the same line, the record company, country of origin, record number, and month and year of issue or of recording. That's the discography section. However, I gave two other sections. One was a composer section, listing the composers alphabetically with their birth and death places and dates, if known, and a listing of their rags, which appear in the discography part, along with their date of copyright registration. This was done to lend historical perspective. It was quite a frequent practice to record a work months before it was published or copyrighted at the Library of Congress. There are a few instances, however, of rags being recorded for the first time 40 or 50 years after they were written and registered. I myself have contributed to that body of recorded ragtime, among many others.
The third section was mainly for those people oriented toward jazz discographies and listed a performer's index where you can see how many ragtime recordings each performer made. Time, 40 or 50 years after they were written and registered. I myself have contributed to that body of recorded ragtime, among many others. The third section was mainly for those people oriented toward jazz discographies and listed a performer's index where you can see how many ragtime recordings each performer made. As I said before, the main reason for compiling this material was to benefit collectors, me. But what kind of collectors, me? There weren't any ragtime record collectors, or there hadn't been until very recently, since publication of Recorded Ragtime. Most people collected jazz records, and they didn't even know they had any ragtime in their collections. Rather, they never thought of it as ragtime, and this, you must realize, was in the late 60s. And before the great ragtime explosion, on Nonesuch and then the Sting, they thought of it as merely peripheral music to jazz. And speaking of jazz reminds me that the most important source of information on ragtime recordings came from 25 large collections in Europe and the United States. Without exception, they were jazz collections which ranged from 10,000 to 200,000 recordings. Where I couldn't personally inspect the records themselves, for instance, those collections in Europe, not having one of those fabulous NEA grants. Didn't exist at the time. Damn, story of my life, always missing out on these marvels. Maybe I could apply now retroactively. I would be sent tape recordings with a sheet listing the pertinent information found on the record label. I was also making tapes myself of all tunes which were easily identifiable as rags for a reference. In every instance, the collectors were extremely cordial and eager to help, either by making their collections available to me for research and taping, or else supplying me with tapes and the information. And as I mentioned earlier, the first of these great collectors and generous and pain in the ass is Dick Spotswood, who started me on this marvelous road by opening up his quite incredible collection for my inspection and delectation and drooling, and now he's sort of ruined it by adding all this other peripheral stuff, ethnic music, and it doesn't swing, Dick, really doesn't, or not the selections you played anyway. Really. What is interesting, I think, is that heretofore no jazz discographer ever listened to a fraction of what was being compiled. Information coming from all over the world with no thought to actually listening. How strange. To the material. And while gathering information, I made a habit of taping as much as I could from these large collections. I had heard approximately 75% of the performances listed in Recorded Ragtime, and 98% of the compositions to verify the fact that a rag was actually recorded and not something in another musical form with a title sounding like a rag. One of the things which has annoyed me about all jazz discographies is the subjective element involved. I'm sure there have been performers and performances which you think of as being jazz, wanting information about them, looking them up, only to be told that, quote, so-and-so's output doesn't come within the scope of this work, end quote. Certainly, I've been bothered by this often, and so I determined that my ragtime discography would contain all rags recorded and by every performer, whether or not I personally liked the rag or the performance. In other words, I did not allow my prejudices to intrude. My idea here being not selective and discriminating, but all-inclusive. It's interesting that for the past 10 years now, I have been using my knowledge of these recordings and exercising extremely critical taste, I like to think, in producing reissue albums for the various specialist labels interested in preserving the best of Recorded Ragtime. Told you what that meant yesterday morning. Here is where my taste can be found, not in a reference book, but in selecting those performances which, in my opinion, best represent whatever it is I have to highlight on that particular album. With this combination of offering an as complete as possible reference book detailing all ragtime recordings issued commercially on 78 RPM, more or less, and offering select examples of the best of them on LPs, I feel gives everyone something useful to have. And so concludes my discographical report on the stated topic. If anybody would like to comment or ask questions about this part of, my God, this is the whole thing, isn't it? Do I have time for 2 minutes more? All right. Well, I wanted to play you several examples of, in my, thank you so much. Is that, look, you go over here, huh? See that? And now, let there be light. Oh, blessings. How absolutely fantastic. I mean, in Canada, does it say the sun never sets or something like that? Isn't that beautiful? Oh, bless you. This is really it's a little strong. However, can I take you home with me? I mean, this is incredible. In my not latest work, no, in my second to last work on ragtime, called Rags and Ragtime, which I wrote with Trevor Titchener of St. Louis fame, it's a musical history and it's the first of its kind, where we do include selected recordings illustrating the important rags, and also a selected rollography listing those important rags and a discussion of them, lumped together in the various composers. What we did for the first time was isolate. Actually, we took it from my introductory essay in Recorded Ragtime, which for the first time I broke down rags as a field generally and broke them down into specific types of rags. And then we wrote Rags and Ragtime based upon the breakdown and expanded it out of all proportion, so that we have things like folk ragtime and popular ragtime, advanced ragtime, novelty ragtime, stride ragtime, the ragtime of Jelly Roll Morton, because he was unique. He deserves a place all by himself. His music is certainly stands alone and far and apart. His rags do, that is. And then the contemporary scene, the ragtime revival. And that fairly outlines rags and ragtime. And what I wanted to do was to illustrate several examples of these different kinds of ragtime, depending on the parts of the country you were in, depending on what era you were in, will also depend upon the type and the sound of ragtime. I think just because we're running out of, and I'm hungry too, probably far hungrier than you. Well, that was some time ago. You don't get this from saying no. I thought I would just briefly go into a musical cliche in ragtime. The most obvious example of a musical cliche in ragtime is what Trevor and I call a 3/4. If you'd like to think of a more elegant term, please advise us, and when we go for a revised edition, we will then painstakingly go through every damn thing and substitute your marvelous phrase for our functional but not very elegant 3/4 description. 3/4 simply means that there are three notes. For instance, played in succession, so that every new measure, the downbeat of it, will contain a new note in succession. This 3/4 principle was a great gimmick. And it became a great gimmick when Charles L. Johnson first used it in the first vegetable rag of 1906, Dill Pickles. That sold a million copies in a very short amount of time. Catchy, bright, 3/4. George Botsford, 1908, said, "Ha, if he can get away with that sleazy bit of nonsense, so can I," and he wrote the next million-selling success, Black and White Rag. These are his three notes. And thinking ahead to 1910, the vaudeville team of Lyons and Yasko, one played a harp and the other played a ukulele, wrote this famous piano rag of theirs, a delicious one called Spaghetti Rag. This is their three notes. Well, you get the idea. And now we come to 1914, where the most recorded rag, certainly on 78 RPM disc, and probably, as a result, the most famous rag. I gave that appellation to Maple Leaf Rag a few minutes ago. It's certainly the most famous of Joplin's rag, but I think the most universal rag is Ude Bowman's 12th Street Rag. His three notes. That's not enough, this miserable guy goes on egging you on. Oh, the whole thing is one theme with variations to it. It's unique in ragtime, not having more than one theme, one section. All of the other sections are really variations on this one section. And that's 304. Then we come to 1921, and Zez Confrey, creator of the novelty rag, did something really extraordinary. He didn't have three notes. He had a combination of three. A fourth, a third, and one. Four, three, one. That's your 3/4 ragtime syncopation. If you would like to write a hit rag selling millions of copies, just remember, you know, your three notes, that's all. It does it every time. This was Kitten on the Keys. I'm sorry, didn't I say that?
No.
Pardon me. You should have recognized it. It's world famous. I didn't do that. A really great folk rag. Actually, it's a stinking folk rag. It's a folk rag that intrigued me. I thought I'd give it its premier performance in Canada. It was written by two piano tuners in Kansas City called Wilson and Rabe. They didn't enjoy first names. They did enjoy their photographs on the sheet music, and it intrigued the life out of me last year when I discovered it, but then it annoyed the hell out of me. And I learn rags for one of two reasons. Either I love it, and it just appeals to me, and I think I can do something with it, or I hate it. And I hate it so much that I have got to learn it, and then see what's wrong, and hopefully learn to love it by putting it right. And in the grand old tradition of the folk ragtime of hearing a theme, and working with it, adapting it, and adding something else, I created the second section. It's a three-theme rag, and the second theme of theirs was very, very similar to their third theme, and that's what really annoyed me about the piece. So what I did to change my annoyance into love was to create the second theme. So this is written by Wilson, Jason, and Rabe. It's called... Right. It's called the Piano Tuner's Walk Away Rag. Thank you. Well, I promised somebody sometime in these last 2 days to do a piece by Harry Gentes. Harry Gentes was a marvelous New York vaudeville composer and songwriter. One of his most famous tunes was the first anti-World War I tune, I Don't Want to Get Well, I Don't Want to Get Well, I'm in Love with a Beautiful Nurse, which was then taken off within the week of publication from general sale, and yet it sold a hell of a lot of copies. It was one of the first underground pieces, I guess, at the surface. See, it was about this injured soldier who was recuperating and didn't want to fight anymore after that, sort of lost the urge to fight. Anyway, Harry Gentes did an extraordinary piece in 1916 for the advanced rag section. These were written by performers for their own use. The popular rag section from 1906 to 1912, when ragtime was truly pop and the top of the charts, if they ever had any then. Peter could have gone back in time a little bit. Instead of starting so late in the day, 1940, he could have gone back to 1900 and come up with some amazing statistics. And he would have found from 1906 to 1912 that ragtime, popular rag, was indeed very popular. And that was done very commercially because the sale, the music business, popular music business, had its basis in the sale of sheet music, not recordings. God, a convention of this nature, not recordings, not cylinders, not piano rolls, but sheet music. And since ragtime demands some sort of a strong left hand, and everybody at home taking lessons are right-handed, posed a little problem. And so the sheet music was simplified for these soft right-handed people, and was not what the performer or the composer intended at all. It was quite a different thing. It was something that would not frustrate the user of the sheet music and encourage them, in fact, to buy more others of the same simple kind. By 1913, however, ragtime lost its first bloom and would have appeared on the second top 20, not in the first top 20 anymore. But it was still around, and it was still influential. But this time, there wasn't a compelling need to cater to the masses, and so that the vaudeville performer was catering to his own special needs and writing his own special material. And so Harry Gentes did, and he wrote this marvelous thing called the Bantam Step. And it's quite unusual in ragtime, or in any kind of music, to try to express himself in a musical fashion with a non-musical idea. In classical music, it's called programmatic music, and it usually falls flat on its face. The most sterling example of this is in Mussorgsky's Pictures in an Exhibition. However, I think you'll find that Harry Gentes, at least I hope you will, in the second section succeeds admirably. This is the Bantam Step. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much indeed.